at the front, representing the state is Michael D. Yes, sir. Is that the way you pronounce your name? Oh, sir. Thank you, Mr. Oster. You may go to the podium. You have 25 minutes and then have 5 minutes to vote. Light will show you you have 5 minutes left.
Sir, I didn't count on the ledge here being covering part of my papers. May it please the court, good morning, Your Honors. I am Assistant Attorney General Michael Oster, and I'm here today to represent petitioners, Warden Jeffrey Endicott, and the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. The question before the court today is, what did the Wisconsin legislature intend when it passed the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act? It is clear that the legislature intended the PLRA to be applied broadly and for one purpose, to reduce the burdens placed on courts by prisoner litigation. Your Honors, I have 2 points today. My first point is, there is no futility exception to the Prisoner Litigation Reform Act's exhaustion requirement. My second point will be that even if there is such an exception, the remedies available to the prisoner in this case were not futile. As to my first point, Your Honors, the Court of Appeals' creation of a futility exception contradicted the clear intent of the legislature. As we all know, the legislature's intent in interpreting a statute is paramount, and here it was to reduce the burden placed on courts. The PLRA achieves the legislature's intent in several ways. First, it gives prison officials a prior opportunity to resolve a case before it reaches the courts, thereby not burdening the courts at all. Second, in those cases that do reach the litigation stage, the record has been developed, both in terms of giving the agency reasoning and possibly some factual considerations. We can look to three sources in deciding what the intent of the legislature was. The first source is the language of the statute itself. There are no exceptions found in the statute. To interpret it otherwise would undermine the purpose of the statute. Put a big hole in the PLRA, effectively.
Counsel, you gave us a case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Very timely, of a United States Supreme Court, which was decided on December 29th.
Yes, Your Honor.
Today is the 30th, so you're right on that. And in that, it interprets the federal statute, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it says no exception for, you have to just exhaust your remedies, right?
Yes, Your Honor. The specific holding, I believe, was that the prisoner was requesting money, monetary relief.
Right.
And the remedies available to him did not explicitly provide for monetary relief, and the court said it doesn't matter, you still have to exhaust that remedy.
So there's no futility exception, right?
No, Your Honor.
In the federal statute. But the federal statute has a provision that says you got to exhaust your administrative remedies. Do we have a comparable statute?
Yes, we do, Your Honor. The statute is 801-07A3. A-B. No prisoner may commence civil action until that prisoner has exhausted all available administrative remedies that the Department of Corrections has promulgated by rule.
So your position is what? Treat them the same?
Yes, Your Honor. The Wisconsin's PLRA was modeled after the federal PLRA. This court has noted that in the past. And in fact, in the Kramer decision, the court held that Wisconsin's PLRA is in fact broader, is to be interpreted broader than the federal PLRA. With that in mind, I've been told that the Wisconsin PLRA does not have a futility exception. In Booth, the Supreme Court looked to the statutory language prior to the PLRA that provided for discretion, and then said that with the new language, any discretion of the court to grant an exception to the exhaustion requirement has been deleted from the statute.
Why does it make sense to not have a futility exception? Let me just put it this way. The department withdrew its rule that's in question here, right?
At the present time, there is an emergency rule in place that overrides the rule that's been challenged. That emergency rule will expire of its own force. They are attempting at the moment to put a new rule in place, but no official rule has been adopted.
Why did they do the emergency rule? Was it because they had too many lawsuits?
There was an emergency rule that was part of a settlement in another case, the Aiello case.
Did he exhaust his remedies in that other case?
The court held that he had, the state had argued that he had not, but that was not a pet. The court decided against the state.
Well, with that background here, you have, if you have to exhaust remedies, it takes longer, right?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
So a rule that might be invalid will be on the books longer and govern, in this case, all the prisoners, right?
Yes, but I don't...
So why don't we just get into court and then settle it out, and the department can then determine whether its rule is valid.
Well, the legislature has made a decision, a policy decision, that it's more beneficial for the state that cases be resolved prior to getting into litigation. And that's the point of the PLRA. While if a prisoner proceeds to court, a case may not be resolved any quicker than if it is resolved at the agency level. At the agency level, they may get relief immediately, or some compromise may be reached, thereby avoiding the burden on the court's time.
How long does the inmate complaint system take, start to finish? Anyway.
That varies. The time limits can be waived in certain instances. I am not aware of exactly what the average time is, Your Honor. It can be expedited, I believe.
But there are specific time limits for the Department of Corrections to respond at each level of review,
yes, Your Honor.
Right?
Yes, Your Honor. Absolutely. Now, the prisoner could file a grievance, and then as soon as the ICE sees it, the ICE could go in and formally resolve that grievance. That the inmate complaint examiner, that's the first person that takes a look at a complaint. In fact, the ICE is specifically encouraged to do so within the administrative code itself. The appendix to the administrative code actually notes that such compromises are commonplace.
Do you have any statistics on that?
Not offhand, Your Honor. But the appendix says that it is commonplace. I believe that is that.
Counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'll find it, counsel.
Oh, okay.
Have you finished responding?
Yes, Your Honor.
I have a question. I'm wondering why this statute is applicable at all. The reason being that the statute, as I understand this case anyway, Mr. Hanslick is contesting a statewide ban, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the statute doesn't say precisely what you say it says on page 9. On page 9, you say, prisoners may not commence a civil action related to prison conditions without exhausting their administrative remedies first. Well, the statute actually says relating to prison conditions in the facility in which he or she has been incarcerated.
Yes, Your Honor.
Seems to me that this challenge is not just to his facility, but it's to the entire state.
I don't believe you can say that a rule affects all facilities and say that it doesn't affect conditions within each individual facility. The PLRA was intended to apply to all civil suits filed by prisoners. We can see that from the revisions made to the statute. Prior statutes show a clear indication to expand the application of the PLRA beyond fact-specific cases. The earlier versions of the statute said that it was applied to all suits filed by prisoners against government officials, state employees, in their official capacity. And I believe later versions, and in the version that applies to this case, that language was changed to all suits related to prisoner jail conditions and defined prisoner jail conditions broadly as anything related to the conditions of confinement, basically anything that goes on inside the prison. clearly all department administrative rules and internal management procedures, including those at issue, at least, at a minimum, relate to prison, to the conditions of confinement. They form the basis for a life and work within the prison. To say that administrative rules and management procedures don't relate to prison conditions would be like trying to say that the rules of baseball don't relate to the game of baseball. You can't change the rules without changing the game. If you change the rules, it's not a prison. If you change the rules of baseball, it's not baseball anymore.
Is this language similar to the federal statute?
I believe it is, yes, Your Honor.
Could I ask, did you finish?
Yes, sir. Yes.
What would have been the value of delay with exhausting the remedies on these particular facts? What could the prison officials or the whole machinery, what they could have done?
As I mentioned before, the informal resolution of complaints is encouraged. The possibilities and opportunities for resolving each particular complaint are only limited by the resourcefulness of the prison officials involved and the willingness of the prisoner to what the prisoner would think would be a fair settlement. We avoid litigation entirely, whether we decide the rule or not, if they resolve whatever conflict lies there. Moreover, if in this case we have a rule that's been challenged, the ICRS, that's the grievance procedure we're talking about, 310, provides that, actually contemplates that rules can be changed as a result of complaints. And if an inmate complaint examiner or a corrections complaint examiner, those are two review levels, if either one of them decide that a rule should change, the administrative rules actually tell them you're to initiate that change. So that the rules do contemplate that, the grievance procedure does contemplate that administrative rules and prison policies can change as a result of grievance procedures. That's one thing. But as to a complete list of what they could have done, it's pretty open-ended.
Counsel, if the rule has been changed here, you've mentioned there's an emergency rule in effect, then don't we have a situation that presents a mootness question?
Yes, Your Honor, it does present a mootness question insofar as the administrative rule regarding sexually explicit conduct. We don't have a new rule in place. We have the emergency rule, which will expire of its own force. And we don't know what a new rule will look like. We may not get a new rule. Until that actually happens, we probably don't have a moot case on that point yet. In any event, we have the internal management procedure that the prisoner challenged is still in place. On a broader scheme, I think this case, the case was not decided on the merits. It was decided on an interpretation of the PLRA. And it's a novel issue that will have statewide impact, and a decision by this court will help clarify the law on a point that is sure to recur.
So even if there is mootness here on at least one of the issues, do you think it's worthwhile for this court to look at this question and make a decision? Is that correct?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Is the rule that has not been changed the rule in regard to having tapes and cassettes?
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. That is an internal management procedure, an agency administrative procedure.
Did this case have anything to do with the resolving that?
Resolving the the IMP regarding tapes is still in place. This case did not have any impact on the settlement in the Aiello case, which was the case where the emergency rule overriding the sexually explicit material rule was put in.
It was part of a settlement agreement.
Yes, as part of a settlement agreement, Your Honor.
Well, you make an argument that I'm looking for a common sense reason to support the position. And it seems to me that a common sense position would be, hey, even in a case involving a constitutional challenge, by forcing the prison officials to look at it in the first instance, may give way to a resolution of the case or even enlighten the officials as to the problems.
Absolutely, Your Honor. As I mentioned to Justice Prosser, the ability to resolve cases, the possibilities of resolving cases are relatively unlimited. And if you resolve a case at that level, if they can reach some agreement, we avoid burdening the courts in any ways whatsoever. Also, it's been noted that even going through the process can help prisoners can go forward, go proceed, can help materially advance, give the prisoner some closure, feel like he's being listened to. Also, we change rules as a result of such procedures.
Counsel, I have a lot more serious moments than you just
It's my first argument. I think another federal case, one of the sources that we could look to for the intent of the legislature are federal decisions in Turbo Creole. We mentioned that earlier. But I'd also like to take a look specifically at Alexander v. Hawk. I think that case is on all fours with this one. It was a prisoner making a facial constitutional challenge to a rule limiting prisoners' ability to access sexually explicit material. It has great similarities to the present case and follows essentially the Supreme Court's reasoning. Moving to my second point, Your Honors, even if a futility exception exists, the remedies available to the prisoner were not futile, and he should be required to exhaust his remedies. Reasons no further than the administrative rules themselves to see this. The rules contemplate both that administrative rules will be challenged within the grievance procedure and that the grievance procedure can look into constitutional questions.
Counsel, apparently that has been done in this other case that you referred to, which was the subject of the February 23rd, 2001, changing the rule.
Yes.
What did that emergency rule say?
The emergency rule basically was, as a result of an agreement, did not entirely eliminate the limitation on access to sexually explicit material, but it did change some language to be more in line with federal rules. Essentially, both sides agreed that the state could, to some extent, or could limit prisoners' access to materials to sexually explicit materials as defined within the rule.
Was that emergency rule put in effect under the auspices of DOC 310.15.5, which reads, if the decision on a complaint requires change in an administrative rule, the decision maker shall initiate making the change in the rule?
I don't believe it was, Your Honor. That rule did not change as a result of the grievance procedure at the prison, but it did change once things had reached settlement. It was part of the settlement, had reached litigation. We can also see in the rules that the Department of Corrections has resources to address constitutional questions. They have both their own Office of Legal Counsel, and they can refer, if the Office of Legal Counsel within the Department of Corrections wants a second opinion, can refer to the Department of Justice. I don't think it should be overlooked that prison officials themselves, people who work within the prisons, are constantly confronted with constitutional questions. They are trained they know that the training they receive and the rules that govern the prison are to a large extent formed by what rights the prisoners have. In conclusion, Your Honors, upholding the Court of Appeals decision would create an exception to the PLRA through which inmate litigation would flow and for which there are indications it was not intended. The paramount question here is whether Wisconsin's legislature thought that the tendency of prisoners to file lawsuits was limited to fact-specific cases? The answer is no. A prisoner will file frivolous lawsuits in a fact-specific case. He will file such a lawsuit challenge, making a constitutional challenge. And if all he needs to do is to make a facial constitutional challenge to get around the exhaustion requirement, the PLRA will be of little use. The burdens on the courts in either case, the fact-specific or the facial challenge, will be the same, and therefore the benefits of the PLRA equally evident.
Counsel, you addressed in your last comments the potential abuse of the process by prisoners, you know, come up with a complaint and add a constitutional number on it, you know, and
yes,
you've got a constitutional violation. I recall correctly, the Court of Appeals opinion in a footnote also referenced the potential of abuse by the Department of Corrections. Footnote 4, they say it is also true, however, that the department can at any time withdraw a modification or restate a or reinstate a repealed rule. In other words, it says the department argues it has the ability to modify or repeal or respond to a complaint. That Court of Appeals footnote suggests abuse by the department. How do you respond to that?
That certainly the Secretary of the Department of Corrections has a responsibility to uphold the Constitution, the state, and state law, as does every law enforcement officer that works within the prisons. I find it hard to presume that they are going to violate that. I don't believe they would, that any person, the DOC is simply not going to run around enforcing rules they believe are constitutional, are unconstitutional. There's a lot of thought put into it. While it may be unusual for a rule to be changed, I think that speaks more to the thought that's put into the rules prior to them being enacted.
Thank you, Counsel. Ms. Hannon, Attorney Hannon, representing Sprigley Hensley.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please the court? I'm Beth Ermatinger Hannon. My client, Mr. Hensley, asks that you affirm the Court of Appeals and conclude that in this narrow circumstance, where a prisoner seeks declaratory relief, confirming that a statewide rule is facially unconstitutional, he or she is not required to go through administrative review levels before reaching a court empowered to grant the only relief he seeks. Affirming the Court of Appeals would be your second option. The first option, as mentioned in the state's reply brief and discussed today, is to conclude that at least a portion of the underlying case is moot. And then, not agreeing with the state, decline to decide the merits of the case at this juncture. In its brief, and today, the state has cited this court's criteria for petitions for review in urging you to go ahead and decide this case. However, this court has articulated other criteria when it has already accepted a case for review, but then determines that the matter between these two parties is moot. Years ago, in In Re Nadia, the court said that criteria it will consider in the exceptional case when it chooses to decide a case that's moot is where there is a matter of great public concern or where the precise situation under consideration arises so frequently that a definitive decision is essential to guide the trial courts. The state has done nothing to show that this is a matter of great public concern. And certainly, it has not shown that this narrow challenge to the facial validity of a statewide rule brought by Mr. Hensley is something that occurs so frequently. In fact, all of the prisoner litigation suits cited in the party's briefs arise from an individual circumstance, most often a disciplinary action involving a particular individual in a particular facility.
Counsel?
Yes.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
And it's maybe more out of curiosity than anything else, but as a practical matter, why does Mr. Hensley want to avoid the administrative review process? I would think if he truly wants to correct what he considers to be conditions that are bad, he might welcome that process.
Your Honor, I'd refer to one of the purposes of a declaratory judgment form of relief is prevention. That's amply identified and discussed in the Lister case. Mr. Hensley filed his complaint in circuit court within 2 weeks of the posting of these pending rules. He did not want them to go into effect. He saw as a corollary to his request for declaratory relief a temporary injunction to halt the implementation of both the publications rule and the cassette rule before they were started. That was denied. But his invocation of the declaratory remedy was to stop this deprivation before it gets started.
And why should the language in 80604, the language in the Declaratory Judgment Act, override the clear language in the Prisoner Reform Act in regard to exhaustion of remedies? That's the way I understand the argument you just gave in answer to Justice Babbage's question. Why should the Declaratory Judgment Act override the Prisoner Reform Act?
The short answer is that the legislature, particularly when it inserted the phrase in the 1997 Act, in the facility in which he or she is incarcerated, did nothing to say that declaratory relief, whether you're talking about 80604 or more specifically 227.40, which addresses declaratory relief when there's a rules challenge, that those should not be accepted. 227.40 specifically states that when a claimant challenges a rule, it is not required to pass through the administrative agency that promulgated the rule. So if the legislature wanted to place declaratory relief seeking a facial challenge to a rule within the confines of the exhaustion requirement, it could have done that, and it didn't.
Well, isn't the state's response to that something like this? The more recent enactment overrides the earlier enactment, and the more specific enactment overrides the more general enactment. How do you respond to that argument?
It depends on if you're looking at the specific litigant, which is the state's position, or the specific and here the only form of relief that's requested. And it would be almost an absurdity to include a claimant like Mr. Hensley within the exhaustion requirement where the ICRS, the inmate complaint review system, cannot give him the relief that he seeks. And I think it was Justice Bradley or Justice Sykes who asked about the length of time involved if one were forced to go through the administrative process before getting to a court which can issue a declaration. We don't know. Just a month or so ago, this court decided Mentec, which involved hearing procedure under the Department of Administration, but there the court decided that exhaustion would not apply, in part because that fellow spent 3 years in the administrative process. Also, I think that case is an example of the limitations of the administrative process, where there, Mr. Mantek was told that his due process and other constitutional claims could not be heard within the departmental hearing system. That same kind of limitation applies here to the ICRS. If you look at the DOC rules and comments, it's designed to help inmates and the staff who work with them live together to understand the confines of institutional living. And it makes sense that for the most part, disciplinary incidents are resolved at the premises where they arise. But Mr. Hensley is not going to benefit by gaining insights. He's seeking to contest the constitutional validity of a rule that affects 20,000 prisoners throughout the state of Wisconsin. And I think the Aiello case, which is the federal court decision that Judge Crabb decided and which prompted the emergency rule as part of a settlement, is a good example of truly the futility of going through the administrative process when there is a rules challenge. Judge Crabb had denied the state's motion for summary judgment, saying that she had grave concerns about the constitutionality of the rule on publications. And as part of the settlement, and as the emergency rule says, to avoid the possibility of having to pay a considerable amount of attorney's fees, the state agreed to implement an emergency rule, which will expire in July, and most likely implement a permanent rule after that.
Why doesn't that experience illustrate that the department can modify and affect their rules? Why doesn't that case bolster the argument that they should have gone through the complaint process and then the department may have said or had an opportunity to say, look, maybe there's something here and we don't want to spend all this money and so we're going to modify it?
Opportunity is there, but I think Aiello illustrates that in the case of this very rule that both Mr. Aiello challenged in federal court and Mr. Hensley challenges in state court, it did not move anyone. The institutional complaint examiner, the corrections complaint examiner, the warden, or the secretary to change anything.
Counsel, the floodgates argument. You know what I mean by that.
Yes, I do.
I'd like you to address that because, you know, this court is concerned with the practical administrative difficulties of the court system.
Certainly. I would not use the term floodgates. I would say that the legislator recognized a narrow channel that had already been dredged, that being the futility exception. Utility exception having been recognized in at least two Court of Appeals decisions addressing the former version of 801027B, State X. Rel. Smith v. McCautry and State X. Rel. Frosch v. Cook. Both of those took as part of the landscape that failure to exhaust where remedies are not futile is fatal. The three The fact that that has been part of the landscape, that the legislature can be taken to have recognized that, comes out naturally in the state's briefs to the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals, where it cites that same proposition in Smith. The Circuit Court cited that. Then it appears the state was surprised by the Court of Appeals' decision, but it had certainly led the Court of Appeals right down that path. It exists, and the state, throughout its brief and in its argument today, talks about the broadness of the PLRA and that its legislative intent is to broadly limit frivolous and malicious prisoner suits. It seems to me that the state is equating the PLRA, if that's 1997 WIS Act 133, which includes multiple provisions, with the singular provision that concerns the court today, the exhaustion requirement. This court said in Kramer that only four provisions of the entire PLRA relate to conditions of confinement. Exhaustion is one of them. But the broadness argument should not sweep you up that every concern that's related to other of the multiple provisions within the PLRA is directly related to the exhaustion requirement. And if the legislative intent was to prevent frivolous and malicious suits, this case is not one of those.
But what is to prevent a prisoner in the future? I mean, there must be hundreds of regulations out there governing prisoner behavior. What is to prevent a prisoner or 100 prisoners from making the allegation that rule number 117.730 is violative of my due process rights and thereby avoids the administrative remedy?
Well, our position is not that an as-applied challenge would have to go through the ICRS. We're concerned with a facial challenge today. That's what Mr. Hensley filed. That's the question before the court. And if your question, Justice Babich, is won't everyone get out the whiteout and make theirs a facial challenge?
Not everyone, but you know that we've got a lot of lawyers out there, would-be lawyers.
Then the first filter that arises is one of the provisions that came out of the PLRA, and that's 802.053, which I've described in my brief as making the circuit court a gatekeeper. That happened in this case. Mr. Hensley filed his complaint in Dean County, and before the state was required to file any responsive document, the circuit court reviewed the complaint to determine whether it was frivolous, whether its purpose was to harass, whether it sought monetary damages, or whether it failed to state a claim. That first screen will weed out cases that are improperly labeled facial challenges to the constitutional validity of the rule. It's got to start somewhere. It's starting with the body that has the power to grant the ultimate relief. The ICRS staff do not. In this case, the circuit court determined that Mr. Hensley's case was not frivolous, was not malicious or meant to harass, he is not seeking monetary damages, and he had stated the claim on both First Amendment and equal protection grounds. And that brings up another distinction between this case and the Booth versus Turner case, which was decided yesterday by the U.S. Supreme Court. That case involved federal PLRA, not the Wisconsin statute. It concerned the inmate complaint system in Pennsylvania, not Wisconsin. The claimant there sought monetary damages, which were not encompassed within the inmate complaint review system there. But ultimately, as the court noted, that state system was changed to allow monetary recovery within the inmate complaint system. And it was not a facial challenge to the constitutionality of the rule or statute. In Wisconsin, the legislature cannot alter the ICRS to give it authority to grant declaratory relief, as the Pennsylvania legislature could change their system to award the monetary relief sought in Booth. The day will not come when a complaint examiner at Columbia can award declaratory relief, finding that a rule is facially unconstitutional.
I have a question about this. When would your client have had to file his complaint in the system? Because I'm looking at your Court of Appeals brief, which had some rejections of complaints because they weren't done in 14 days. So do you have to file against the, this is Mr. Hensley's pro se brief. Do you have to file against this rule within 14 days after its effective date?
I believe that is the rule, that the rule states 14 days after the occurrence, whether that's a disciplinary act, the subject matter that the person is complaining of, they're required to file within 14 days. Now, I believe Mr. Hensley met that requirement, but he didn't go through ICRS. He filed a complaint in Dane County. He did have some correspondence, which you may be referring to.
Well, what I'm getting at is, suppose 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 2 months after this rule is promulgated, then goes into the corrections complaint, the Department of Corrections complaint process. And what are they going to do, kick it out because he didn't bring it within 14 days?
I think that's possible, but I believe Mr. Oser also said that there is room for extensions of time. I haven't looked.
Yeah. You have to ask for it.
I believe they would have to ask for an extension of time to file it. Referring to the
14-day time period. What I'm getting at is, I mean, if something happens to you and they remove the cassettes, you know it. 14 days, that's reasonable. If there's a rule out there, general application, but it hasn't been applied to you, I want to know whether that 14-day period applies, and maybe you're the wrong one to ask, and I'll ask Mr. Oser, but at least one of the rejections of complaint would so indicate. That raises a different kind of question, but raises whether it's really futile to have a department to review of this kind of case.
Mr. Alder might be able to clarify that, Your Honor.
Good.
But
yeah,
referring to some of those attachments in the Court of Appeals brief, that brief itself is not part of the record, but some of those attachments there were referred to in Mr. Hensley's motion for reconsideration after the circuit court had dismissed his complaint. And in his motion for reconsideration, he said, I can give you examples where others have challenged this rule and have been told by the ICRS staff that a constitutional challenge like this is beyond the scope. Several of those documents are part of the record attached to his motion. Not part of the record, but attached to his Court of Appeals brief, not objected to by the state, are some additional responses from ICEs to inmates challenging these same rules and saying it's beyond the scope of our system. That's just a practical aside.
14 days.
Well, I read it in terms of the constitutional. There are several in there. That isn't necessary to your decision. It's just another practical example that these staffers in this ICRS system is not designed, not capable of granting the relief in the narrow circumstance presented by Mr. Hensley.
But counsel, is that a problem? That might be a problem for the client. I look at this church, what is the name? The Turner case, Booth versus Turner, and I haven't had time to look at it carefully, but there's language that states the dispute here then comes down to whether or not a remedial scheme is available, where, as in Pennsylvania, the administrative process, and this is what I'm emphasizing, has authority to take some action in response to a complaint, but not the remedial action and inmate demands to the exclusion of all other forms of redress. Your argument that, come on, you know, some staffer at Columbia isn't going to be able to declare this facially unconstitutional rings with me. Of course they're not going to. But aren't they able to take some action in response to a complaint, perhaps some action as found in the Department of Corrections 310.14 sub 310.15 sub 5, which I referenced earlier, an argument that deals with the department has essentially authority to make changes or modifications. My question is this language a problem for you? Tell me if it is not, and if it is, how you get around it.
I would say it is not a problem for me. If it's a serious concern for the court, I'd ask that both parties be given an opportunity to submit a letter brief addressing the Supreme Court decision that came out yesterday. I don't know that it's necessary, but if the court is interested, I think that would be an appropriate step. The distinctions between Booth in this case include the fact declaratory relief was not sought in Booth, monetary damages were. That's the federal PLRA applied. We have different language in the Wisconsin exhaustion requirement portion of the Wisconsin PLRA. The board decision says some process, an administrative process, whatever it is, basically, is a remedy, so you have to exhaust. Booth wasn't asked to talk about the nature of declaratory relief, and in Wisconsin we have 80604, we have 227.40 that talk about declaratory relief. We have case law interpreting it. Castile versus Cole, a 1993 decision by the Court of Appeals, where a prisoner challenged the constitutionality of a DOC rule governing the prison disciplinary process is unconstitutional. The exclusive means of judicial review of validity of the rule is an action under 227.40 says a declaratory judgment may be rendered whether or not the plaintiff has first requested the agency to pass upon the validity of the rule. I don't know if there were similar statutes like that in Pennsylvania talking about when a prisoner can ask for monetary relief, but we have a different set of circumstances here. The state talks about a futility exception being created by the Court of Appeals, and I suggest that's a misnomer, that has been read as part of our common law, as included in the earlier version of the 801.027b, and it, futility in a sense closes the circle in talking about what kinds of remedies are available and meaningful. Published decisions on prisoner litigation suggest that any courts are going to be inundated with facial challenges to administrative rule. Nor would your decision to affirm the Court of Appeals take power away from the ICRS. That staff, that system is still in place to handle the day-to-day matters that come up within a particular institution. But if you were not to affirm the Court of Appeals, you would in effect render the language added to 801.027b in 1997 in the facility in which the prisoner is incarcerated or detained superfluous, and that's not the proper role of statutory interpretation. That particular phrase in the Wisconsin statute modifies the type of claim that's subject to exhaustion. In the federal PLRA, which the state hearkens to as the inspiration for various provisions in the Wisconsin law, the federal PLRA says no action shall be brought with respect to prison conditions under 1983 or this title or any other federal law by a prisoner confined in any jail, prison, or other correctional facility until such administrative remedies as are available are exhausted. there, confined in any jail or prison, modifies who? Not what. It's a different statute.
Why can't...
We have to take... Yes.
Please.
We have to take the Wisconsin legislature to see what it said when it deliberately chose to add that modifier about the type of claims encompassed by the exhaustion requirement.
Why can't that language in the facility in which he or she has been incarcerated be interpreted almost like a standing, quasi-standing, you know? We don't want you in Green Bay complaining about something that doesn't affect you in Green Bay, but only affects you in, you know, Columbia. So it's almost a standing sort of thing.
That would be one way to look at it. Although under this court's First Amendment jurisprudence, persons are allowed to raise claims that affect others. So for this case today, it is not that kind of limitation.
Don't the rules of issue in this case affect the or govern the conditions in the facility at issue in this case?
They certainly govern conditions in Columbia, where Mr. Hensley resides, and they govern all adults, 20,000 or so, throughout the state of Wisconsin.
The fact that they govern everybody doesn't mean that they don't govern the conditions in the facility at issue in this case, and so the statute is applicable. The exhaustion requirement is applicable. It's not inapplicable merely because they go beyond the facility. And that seems to be what you're arguing. Right?
I'm arguing that it is limited to a complaint arising out of a grievance or an event or occurrence in that facility. This rule, the rules that Mr. Hensley is complaining about were posted throughout the state, applied throughout the state.
Grievance occurred out of a general rule that applies across the all the institutions. It would be governed by this statute, wouldn't it? I think that's Justice Sykes.
Right. The exhaustion requirement is not rendered inapplicable merely because what's targeted is something that applies across the board, not just in the facility.
Right.
This statute is construed only to apply to something that happens in a particular institution and to exclude from the exhaustion requirement anything that applies across the board. It seems to me, as counsel for the state suggests, we've just created a huge loophole.
Well, I think it's part of the analysis, and certainly the DOC rules, or at least the notes to them, describe an as-applied constitutional challenge, but not a facial challenge. If you read this language, if you consider State X. Rel. Smith, State X. Rel. Frosch, the history of the futility exception, and the limitations of the relief that the ICRS can afford, you will affirm the Court of Appeals.
I don't quite understand. What is the source of authority to either create or recognize a futility exception?
The prior version of 801.02.7b was enacted in 1995. The Court of Appeals in State X. Rel. Smith versus McQuadtree recognized the futility exception to the exhaustion requirement as it existed then. The Court of Appeals in State X. Rel. Frosch v. Cook also recognized it.
Okay, now they recognized it, but
yes.
How did they get the authority to do that?
In part, they referred to prior case law applying common law principles of exhaustion where administrative remedies are futile. State X. Rel. Brown v. Cranky, which relied on another prisoner challenge to DOC rules, case laws versus Milwaukee. And I believe those courts recognize that it's the nature of the relief, something that the system can't afford provide, which makes it futile, but the legislature is taken to be aware of case law interpreting its statutes up to the point when it wants to make a change. And based on that, and what the legislature has already said about no exhaustion required when you're challenging a rule in 227.40, taking that together, futility applies in this circumstance.
Except those cases all predate the PLRA.
They do. They do. They don't predate the principle that exhaustion could apply to a challenge to DOC practices.
But they're premised on exhaustion as a discretionary doctrine, judicially created discretionary doctrine, and specifically exclude statutorily required exhaustion.
They are premised on the common law principles, and the legislature can be taken to have been aware of those, and it did nothing, either in 1995 or when it had the opportunity to change in 1997, to expressly say this, that there is no more futility in an instance such as a declaratory judgment action challenging facial validity.
Except the legislature did impose a statutory exhaustion requirement for prisoner litigation, which did not previously exist. A very broad exhaustion requirement in 7B, right?
It did codify that. That's right.
And that did not previously exist at the time that those cases
that's
were decided
right.
based
that's
upon
right.
a common law judicially created exhaustion doctrine. And the case law stands for the proposition, federal and state, that where there is statutory exhaustion, it's not discretionary in the judge to waive it or require it.
I think State X. Rel. Smith and Frosch are both they're looking at the 1995 version, which had an exhaustion requirement codified for prisoner litigation. It was revised in 1997, and it was narrowed to include this in the facility in which the prisoner is incarcerated. So never did the state say no more futility. They could have. They didn't. They knew 227-40 was standing there. And they didn't make that connection. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hammond. Mr. Poster?
Opposing counsel is correct that the legislature is presumed to know the law for the purpose of the statute, and it did. Look at the PLRA, the provision that requires exhaustion. If there was an exhaustion requirement under the common law, it did not make it into the statute. The statute contains no exceptions for that futility. The Booth reasoning, the reasoning in Turner versus Booth, that had been adopted by the 11th and the 7th Circuit, or was the 11th and 7th Circuit also used, applies here. They said that if all a prisoner had to do to get around the PLRA was plead, was ask for remedies that weren't available to get around the PLRA, the PLRA wouldn't be much good. There'd be a big hole in it. The same applies here. If all a prisoner has to do is throw in a rule saying a facial constitutional challenge to get around the PLRA, the benefits of the PLRA will evaporate. You'll have courts having to consider these things. And the legislature has made a judgment, a policy decision, that it wants agencies to have prior review to try and resolve as many of these as possible, even meritorious claims. The point is that claims get resolved and the courts don't have to deal with them. That even good claims, when the DOC and the prisoners come together, they reach an agreement and there basically is no controversy anymore, there's no conflict. That's the great public concern here, is that if an exception to the exhaustion requirement is read in, the benefits will evaporate and courts will have to consider these questions. That's why I would urge this court to make a decision in this case on all the issues that have been brought up, including the administrative rule that has been challenged.
Are there any suits that can be brought without exhausting remedies, in your view, by prisoners under this statute?
In State versus, yes, Your Honor, but let me explain. In State versus Kramer, the State versus Kramer, this decision goes through some of the legislative history. It does a pretty good job going through the legislative history and points out that the drafters wanted, were, some people had concerns that the law would, had gone beyond just the civil realm, had bridged into maybe being going into habeas corpus. And they said, wait, we don't want that. They wanted to draw it back, but they wanted it to apply to all civil actions. I don't think there is a civil action related to conditions of confinement that it does not apply to.
Let me see if I can create it. Suppose you had an institution in which all the prisoners were being tortured. Got to go through administrative remedies for that? Exhaust administrative remedies for that?
There's an imminent danger exception to the PLRA that allows you to go around the exhaustion requirement, I believe.
Go to court?
Yes.
Are you sure?
I apologize, Your Honor. I'm
working on it.
One to ten with 10 being the most confidence.
9.5.
Tell the court to look it up.
I can go look it up right after this and send the court a letter about that. Just to make sure. I think opposing counsel mentioned that there wasn't the Court of Appeals did not characterize this as a futility exception. I disagree. The Court of Appeals specifically talked about how the DOC was not capable of considering constitutional questions. Nothing could be considered more futile. And that, therefore, the court was creating a futility exception. I think I've shown that the rules do contemplate that the DOC is, the rules are designed to consider constitutional questions, and the DOC has the resources for that.
Has the state changed its position over this the course of this action so that previously the state thought there was a futility exception?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that I've explained that in the brief, I believe, in footnote 2 in my reply brief. Given the reliance that the Court of Appeals placed on an exception to futility, for the research I found that I did not think there was one. Other questions? Thank you.
No, I would like counsel to approach the bench, but I would like the court, if you can, to just meet for a few moments in the in our conference room outside. So if the counsel would approach the bench.